quite an often misunderstood passage. It's quite technical, so we're going to need our Bibles in front of us to understand what's going on here. But we're here to figure out what God has to say to us and why he's saying it. And I thought, because it is a little misunderstood, quite understand, feel free to ask them afterwards and I'll see what I can do. But anyway, I want to begin by talking about, the phrase McCarthyism. Have you heard of the phrase McCarthyism? Most people above my age have heard of it. It comes from US Senator Joseph McCarthy, who in the late 1940s and early 50s led a campaign to weed out communists in the United States. But here's the thing, McCarthyism is not synonymous with democracy or even anti-communism. McCarthyism refers to how the witch hunts of the 40s and 50s made accusations without proper regard for evidence. They made accusations without proper regard for evidence. So hundreds and hundreds of Americans lost their jobs, lost their careers, were sometimes even imprisoned because they found themselves on lists that were based more on suspicion than on actual evidence. So McCarthyism literally means making accusations without proper regard for evidence. And what Paul is doing in our passage today is the exact opposite of McCarthyism. All right, he's identifying people through evidence. But this identification, it's infinitely more important than whether you're a communist or not. All right, this identification is about whether you're saved or not. This is what Paul has been on about ever since the beginning of the letter. All right, he's been talking about the gospel of God. Romans 1 verse 1, all right, he introduced the gospel of God. And what is the gospel of God? Well, we saw in Romans 1:16, the gospel of God is the power of salvation. And that's what he cares about. He cares about salvation. And ever since Romans 1:16, Paul has been showing that salvation is not, all right, Jew versus Gentile. Contrary to what most ethnic Jews in Paul's day thought, God has never just saved the Jews, allowed all the Jews to go to heaven, and condemned all the Gentiles, sent all the Gentiles to hell. Rather, Romans 2, 7 and 8, we saw it is those who do good that get eternal life, whereas those who do evil get trouble and distress, all right? The gospel says and has always said that it is salvation is righteous versus wicked, okay? Righteous versus wicked. But this begs the question, how do I know which category I'm in? I know if I'm a Jew or a Gentile, that's pretty easy, but how do I know whether I'm one of the righteous or one of the wicked? I mean, we're talking about salvation here. We're talking about eternity here. Right? I don't know, how do I know which one I'm in? How do I know whether I'm going to heaven or not? Because let me tell you, McCarthyism's suspicion is not going to cut it when it comes to eternity. I need evidence. And this is what Paul is offering us in today's passage. He's offering us evidence for how we can identify which category we fall into. And I've got 3 points to help us see this today, as your sermon outline shows. So we're going to begin by seeing why this topic is so important to all of us. All right, it's important to all of us because, as we're going to see, being a member of a church is not how you identify yourself as the righteous or the wicked. The fact that you are here this morning, it's wonderful, but that is not how we identify whether we are part of the righteous or the wicked. And what that means is there are some members of our church who have been here for years, maybe decades, who are not actually saved, right? So this covers all of us. So our first point is how not to identify the righteous and the wicked. Our second point is how to identify the wicked. We're going to look at how to identify the wicked. That's in verse 9b to 18, and then we're going to follow that by how to identify the righteous in verses 19 to 20. And the importance of all of this is to have proper evidence for whether we're saved or not. And statistically speaking, there will be people here this morning that cover that fall into both categories. So let's find out, all right, if we're not in the right one through seeing how not to identify the righteous and the wicked, how to identify the wicked, and how to identify the righteous. So, our passage begins with Paul re-asking his question from chapter 3, verse 1. So if you just turn back one page, have a look at the question he asked in chapter 3, verse 1. What advantage then is there in being a Jew? Right? If God has always saved the righteous and condemned the wicked, then being one of God's Old Testament people, being one of the Jews, that doesn't automatically get me into heaven. So what advantage is there in being a Jew? And we saw, verse 2, much in every way, because the Jews have been entrusted with the very words of God. Right? The Jews have the instruction manual. They were given the instruction manual in how to get close to God. How to get close to the greatest treasure in existence. Right? What's our vision statement here at church? We exist to bring glory to God by calling all to delight in Him as our ultimate treasure. God is the ultimate treasure. And the Jews were given the treasure map to that treasure. In the Count of Monte Cristo, Edmond Dantès is falsely imprisoned for treason. He goes away for like 15 years. While he's there, he meets another prisoner by the name of Abbé Faria. And when Faria is close to death, he tells Dantès the whereabouts of an enormous buried treasure. Now, the only thing better than knowing the whereabouts of an enormous buried treasure is finding said treasure and using it. And as the book goes on, that's what Dantès does. And that's what the Jews had. They had the treasure map to the greatest treasure in existence. There's only one thing that's more blessed than that, and that's using the treasure map to get the treasure. Right? There is enormous advantage in being a Jew. However, as Paul says in verse 3, some didn't use that advantage. Right? There were unfaithful Jews in the Old Testament who ignored the treasure map. And these unfaithful Jews make us question again whether there is actually an advantage in being a Jew. I mean, yes, they've been entrusted with the very words of God, but if they're going to ignore it, right? So this is why Paul asks again in verse 9. Here's the first verse of our passage. What shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? Paul's answer this time is, what does it say? Not at all. What? Is that right? Now, this is where we're going to have to get a little technical for a second, because the phrase that is translated not at all is a Greek phrase, upantos. U meaning not, and pantos meaning all or altogether. And the way this phrase is usually translated is not altogether. Right? U, not, pantos, altogether. Not altogether. But that's different to what we've got in the NIV in front of us. We've got altogether not, or not at all. Now, the reason the NIV has gone for this is there's two reasons. Number one, it's a misunderstanding of where Paul goes from here, but we're going to see that in our second point. So we're going to come to that misunderstanding in our second point. The other reason they've gone for not at all is because upantos can sometimes be translated as not at all. And so context has to tell us the key. Now, they've gone for this one because they believe they're looking at the context that follows it. I'm going to show why that's misunderstood in a second. But the context we've got here is that Paul just said only seven verses earlier that there's much advantage in being a Jew. And so to go for this translation of altogether not means that Paul is directly contradicting himself just seven verses after he said there's much advantage. There is an advantage in being a Jew. They have the treasure map for the greatest treasure in existence. The issue is not all of them use that treasure map, so it's actually only a partial advantage. And that's why, contrary to the NIV, the preferred translation of verse 9 is, do we have any advantage? Not altogether. There is an advantage. The Jews were given the treasure map, but that advantage is null and void if they don't respond with the obedience of faith. Right? Upantos means not altogether. It is only advantage if they respond with the obedience of faith. And friends, it's the same with the church today. Right? Statistically speaking, there are some sitting here today who come to church every week and who read their Bible all the time. and it makes zero impact on their lives. Right? Their actions and their heart are no different to the wicked, to the non-Christians. Please understand that being a member of a church or reading your Bible every day is not how you identify as part of the righteous. Why? Because those things make zero difference come judgment day. Right, let me read to you Jesus' own words. This is in the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" Friends, simply having the treasure map, or even reading the treasure map, or even listening to the treasure map get proclaimed on a Sunday is not how you identify the righteous and the wicked. Right? Thinking that going to church or reading the Bible is enough is just as wrong as the Jews thinking that being a Jew was enough. Right? That is not how you identify who the righteous and the wicked are. So how do we? Well, for this we turn to the second half of verse 9. Now that little four there, it starts with four. That's the link between what we just saw with upantos and what's about to follow. Four, we've already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. Now, this is where I think this passage is widely misunderstood, because we need to ask ourselves, what is the charge? What exactly is the charge that Paul has already made? And again, we need to get a little technical, okay, for a second. When verse 9 says, Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin, does that mean Paul is making a charge against every single person on the planet? Is this a universal indictment? Because that's not what we've seen in the letter so far. Nowhere has Paul talked about the whole world so far. Rather, what Paul has said is, the righteous are those who live by faith, Romans 1:17. All right, the righteous are both Jews and Gentiles who exhibit the obedience of faith, and they're the people who God praises, Romans 2:29. But alongside that, the wrath of God is being poured out on the wicked, both Jews and Gentiles, and they're the ones that don't have the obedience of faith. So when Paul says in verse 9, for we've already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin, is this a universal indictment on all of humanity? And that's what most people think. Or is it an indictment that the wicked, both Jews and Gentiles, are under the power of sin? Now again, context is going to have to give us the understanding of this. I've already shown you the context beforehand has nothing about the whole of the world. What about the context after? Because Paul goes on to back up his argument by bringing together a whole bunch of Old Testament quotes in verses 10 to 18. So in verses 10 to 18, he's taking all these quotes from the Old Testament and he's bringing them together to support his argument from verse 9. But the thing is, when you look at each of those quotes in their original context, none of them are an indictment on the whole of humanity. They're actually only an indictment on the wicked in contrast to the righteous. Now, we don't have time to look at them all, okay? So let's just look at the first one. But please understand, so the first one's from Psalm 14. Please understand, all of these passages do the same thing. So let's read, I've just got four verses here. So Psalm 14, for the director of music of David. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are vile, there is no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, any who seek God. All have turned aside, they have together become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Will evildoers never learn? Those who devour my people. Now, who's Paul talking about here? Who is the one who never does any good? It's the fool. It's the one who says there is no God. And that can't include David, because David is writing a prayer to that God called Psalm 14. Right? So Psalm 14 is not a universal indictment on all of humanity. It is an indictment on the wicked, saying that they are under the power of sin. And it's an indictment on the wicked in contrast to who? The righteous, my people, in verse 4. Here's the thing. If Paul wanted to make an indictment on all of humanity, there are plenty of passages in the Old Testament to do that. I mean, the theology is correct. We believe that every single human is under sin, right? Let me give you just one. This is from Ecclesiastes 7:20. There is not a righteous man on earth who does what is right and never sins. So that's a universal indictment. And there's a whole bunch of those passages. And Paul doesn't choose one of them. Instead, he chooses passages that only condemn the wicked. So, let's go back to Romans chapter 3, okay? What is Paul doing here? If he is making a universal indictment in verse 9 against all humanity, right? No one is righteous. Then what that means is, number one, Paul is treating the Old Testament with a complete lack of respect because he's taking it out of context. And he's doing so to support an argument that he hasn't actually made yet in Romans. Friends, Romans 9:3-18 is not saying there is no one righteous. It's identifying who the wicked are. And the wicked are those who are under the power of sin. That's what it says in verse 9. They're under sin. And what does it mean to be under sin? Well, Paul uses a slightly different phrase in Romans 6. He says the wicked are slaves to sin. And the reason the wicked are slaves to sin is because they are worshipping a master that is not God. Now, the thing about being a human is everyone worships. Everyone has something in their life that is their ultimate treasure, that they think fulfillment and satisfaction and happiness in life is going to come from. But if that thing is not God, then you're going to worship something else. You're going to think something else is going to give you satisfaction and meaning and happiness in life. And the descriptions that Paul gives in Romans 10-18 are those who worship something other than God. Have a closer look with me, all right? Those with tongues that practice deceit, verse 13. What do liars worship? They worship their reputation. The reason I lie is because I don't want people to find out really just how bad I am. All right? They are slaves of their reputation. What about those who gossip and slander? The poison of vipers is on their list, 13b. These people worship feeling good about themselves. But why do people gossip? They gossip because they are desperate to find someone who agrees with me against that person over there that I'm having a disagreement with. And if I can find someone who agrees with me, then I feel better about myself. They're slaves to feeling better about themselves. Those who are quick to shed blood, verse 15, what do they worship? They worship success. I'm going to do whatever it takes in this life to get ahead, and woe to you if you get in my way. Those who oppress people, who bring misery and ruin, verse 16, what do they worship? They worship power. You are here for my gratification. And those who do not know the way of peace, verse 17, what do they worship? They worship stuff. What is pretty much every war about? It's about you have something that I want. We can add our own to these. Those who don't tithe worship money. All right? After my mortgage and my phone plan and my wardrobe and my entertainment, Lord, if there's some left over, maybe. They're slaves to money. Those who think it okay to date non-Christians, they worship acceptance, right? Feeling loved and feeling accepted by someone nice is more important than not being yoked to a non-believer. They worship acceptance. Friends, the way we identify ourselves as part of the wicked is by asking, is there some sin in my life that just doesn't bother me? Well, I know the Bible says it's wrong. Brennan and James tell me it's wrong all the time. But I just don't care because I want that thing more than I want God. Right? The reason we don't care about a particular sin in our life is because we're under the power of that sin. It's because we're worshipping something other than God. It could be your career, money, power, love, sex, marriage, popularity, reputation, you name it. If we worship those things as of greater importance than God, then we are under its power. And it will make us do what verses 10 to 18 are telling us. Now, the big problem with this identification, right, the wicked are under the power of sin, big problem with that is that, well, Christians still sin. And Christians still worship things other than God from time to time. See, becoming a Christian doesn't make you perfect, doesn't make you sinless. So chances are, many of us are sitting here thinking, okay, but isn't everyone under the power of sin, Brendan? And the answer is no. The reason the answer is no is because there is a big difference between being under the power of sin and sinning. So Paul goes on in Romans 6 to explain this difference. He says, the wicked are slaves to sin, the righteous are slaves to righteousness. Now, that doesn't mean that the righteous still don't sin. We still sin. The difference is we're not owned by that sin. Rather, we fight that sin. We hate that sin. We want that sin gone from our lives. Right? So that's the big difference between the identification of the wicked and the identification of the righteous. The wicked don't care about that sin because they want this other thing more than God. The righteous are fighting our sin. We hate that sin and we want that sin gone. And there is one very big reason why the righteous do this, and we see that in verses 19 and 20. So have a look. Romans 3:19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those under the law. Now who are those under the law? It's the Jews, okay? The Jews were given the law in the Old Testament, both righteous and wicked. And why does the law speak to the Jews? Read on. So that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Now, this is where Paul's argument turns universal. This is the first time Paul has mentioned the whole world in his letter so far. And what does the law have to say to the whole world? Verse 20. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by the works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. Now, Paul is not saying no one will be declared righteous. In the following chapter, he says Abraham was declared righteous. So we can't be saying no one's righteous. What he's saying is no one is declared righteous by the works of the law, by following the law. And this is how you identify the righteous. The righteous know that their standing before God has nothing to do with their works. Why? Because the law told them in no uncertain terms that they were sinful. The reason the law told them that is because to follow the law, you have to offer sacrifices for your sin. So every day you are reminded that you're sinful, because you're offering sacrifices for that sin. And so the righteous, according to verses 19 and 20, are those who know everyone is accountable to God. And therefore, but for the grace of God, go I. Right? The righteous are those who know, but for the grace of God, go I. When the righteous see God's condemnation of the wicked, they say, that should be me. Right? The righteous know we're sinful, and we know there's nothing we can do that can make up for that sin, and so we throw ourselves at the mercy of God. Let me explain it this way. When Jesus was arrested, Pilate actually wanted to let him go. Right? So he'd no doubt heard about all the good things Jesus had been doing. He's actually warned by his wife in Matthew 27:19. His wife says, have nothing to do with that man. I have been deeply troubled by a dream today. Where did that dream come from? But on top of that, after talking to Jesus, he would have seen that he was a good man. And so what Pilate did, I mean, he had a custom. He's trying his hardest to try and release Jesus. And so he came up with a plan. His custom at Passover was to release one Jewish prisoner. And so he tries to force the Jews' hands by putting a ridiculous choice before them. Do you want me to release Jesus, who has done nothing deserving of death, or do you want me to release the absolute worst criminal we have in the jail at the moment, Barabbas, who is not only a terrorist, but he's a murderer? Which one do you want? And they choose Barabbas. Now imagine if Barabbas, right, in utter shock at his miraculous stroke of good fortune, decides to follow this crazy mob that just called for his release. And imagine he followed them all the way to Calvary. What would he be thinking, do you think? He'd be thinking something like, that's supposed to be me. I'm supposed to be on that cross, not him. There but for the grace of God go I. Friends, the righteous are those who see God's condemnation of the wicked and realize that should be me too. There is nothing different between me and them. Right? The whole point of the law, according to verses 19 and 20, is to show that the righteous cannot fulfill the law by their own power. We are accountable to God too. And the only reason I'm not condemned is because God, in his infinite grace, condemned his Son in my place. And this is what makes the righteous fight our sin rather than be owned by it. Because Jesus died to take it away. Now, it's not easy. It's not easy fighting sin. It is a lifelong battle. Right? The reason it's a lifelong battle is because we are breaking decades and decades of addiction. The reason organizations like AA exist is because it's not easy breaking decades of bad habit. And so the righteous are going to continue to fail. We're going to continue to be drawn back into sin. But the thing that makes the difference between sinning and being owned by sin, being a slave to sin, is that we want to fight it. That's what identifies the righteous. It is those who want to fight with everything we have. And the greatest weapon we have is the gospel. Because the gospel reminds us we are serving a good master. See, we're used to serving bad masters. We're used to serving masters who punish us when we get it wrong, right? If I don't lie, then everyone will find out how horrible a person I am and my reputation will be ruined, right? If we serve our reputation, it punishes us when we do the wrong thing. If I don't find someone who agrees with my complaints, then maybe I'm the one in the wrong and I'll feel terrible about myself. Right? If we worship and serve our own opinion of ourselves, we get punished when we mess up. If I don't step on this person and get ahead, then my career will come to a standstill. Right? Our career punishes us if we get it wrong. So the reason the righteous find it hard to exhibit the obedience of faith is because we constantly think God is like that too. We constantly think God is going to punish us if we get it wrong. We think God is the kind of God like all the other things, all our other masters. And that's why the best weapon we have is continuing to remind ourselves that our God is the one master who will not punish us. And we know that because we've seen him give our all, give his all for us. That's the kind of master we should be serving. How can we not fight our sin to serve him through the obedience of faith?